Most of this week's discussions about the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic have been with historians, archaeologists, and scientists, but we thought it might be a good idea to look at it on a more personal level today, despite the fact that my guest, Christine Quinn, is a prominent political figure in this town. I'm pleased to welcome the New York City Council Speaker back to our show, in this case to talk about her grandmother, who was on the doomed ocean liner and survived.
Yep, thank you very much. Yeah, my maternal grandmother, her maiden name was Nellie Shine, her married name was Nellie Callahan, and she came over from Ireland in steerage in third class, and she was from Newmarket in County Cork and went over to Cove and caught the ship. We're not exactly clear how old she was. She lived to over 100, maybe 100, 203. So she was probably 16 or 17 when she was on the boat.
And the New York Daily News reported that she listed spinster next to her occupation on her boarding documents.
I wonder whether she did that or some horrible man who was doing the paperwork. It seemed cruel for a 16 or 17-year-old girl to be listed as that as her occupation. When she came here, her occupation became a nanny.
Now, when the movies always seem to suggest that the Titanic, that inaugural trip, was a glamorous thing, nobody seems to mention people in steerage. How many people were in steerage?
You know, I don't know how many people were in steerage overall. I think it was not uncommon for these luxury liners to have the bowels of the boat kind of set aside for, you know, the cheap seats, so to speak, where people would come, immigrants would come to America. It is believed that more, notwithstanding women and children first, that more first-class men probably made it off alive than third-class steerage women or girls, which is where she was.
She was one of only 40
right.
Irish survivors.
Right.
Was she traveling alone?
She was. She was. She came from a big family in Newmarket, and her parents were dead, and her sister took in an orphan from the village, and basically her sister had too many mouths to feed. So she said that my grandmother had to go to America to meet her brother and her cousin, who were already here in Hell's Kitchen.
So the assumption was that they would help her get on her feet.
Exactly.
And there were a lot of Irish immigrants coming
absolutely.
To America. This is
absolutely.
Even after the potato famine.
Right. No, absolutely. I mean, people were coming here for a better life, to kind of have the American dream come true. So there were lots, all four of my grandparents about that same time came from Ireland.
Now, whenever I've spoken to somebody who had a relative who went through some incredible experience,
right.
whether it was World War I, World War II, whatever, they always say the same thing. They were reluctant to talk about it.
Oh, she was completely reluctant to talk about it.
Why do you think? It was such an important moment in her life. She could have died at 16.
You know, I think when I look at how reluctant she was, just to give you a sense, my mother was taught about the Titanic in school. And she came home and said, "Mom, there was a girl in the Titanic who survived who had your name." And her mother said, "No, Mary, that was me." I mean, that was in eighth grade. And we were told never to ask her about it because it was too upsetting, though I did ask her about it once or twice. But when she was older and had Alzheimer's, in her dementia, it's all she talked about. In a state of very upsetting terror, she would just scream about the boat and a man with a gun. And because I think the story goes there was one lifeboat where a man got shot who had gotten into it. I don't know exactly why. I think it probably had to do with some type of, you got here. It wasn't like they had therapists or grief counselors lined up to talk to them. She had to go on with her life. And I suspect it was stuffed away in a place that made it manageable until it couldn't be anymore.
Well, before she had the Alzheimer's, when you asked her about it, what would she tell you?
She told me a story she told me the story about her sister and the orphan, and that her sister had decided very quickly she had to go. I guess the custom was to get somebody in your town to give you a religious medal. And everyone in the town prayed to that saint for your safe transport.
So this is kind of like taking a St. Christopher's medal
exactly,
on a trip.
Exactly. And you then sent the medal back from America, and it was a very powerful medal. So she was on her way to Cove to meet the boat, and she bumped into a school teacher. And because she had finished eighth grade, so she had, compared to some of my other grandparents, quite a lot of education. And her school teacher said, "To whom should I pray for your transport?" And she said, "Oh, I've been sent so quickly, I don't have a sponsor. You know, I don't have a saint. So her teacher and my grandmother and my mother and my aunt were always like this. They had a million little relics or medals pinned to their bras. So she took a medal off of her bra, gave it to my grandmother, and said, "Here you go." And my grandmother said she was always so upset because she lost the medal when the ship sank, and she felt so terrible she couldn't send it back because clearly this woman's prayers and medal were what saved her. That's the only story she ever told me.
In the movie Titanic, people in steerage weren't allowed to leave.
No.
Do you have any sense of how she wound up on a boat when so many people, you know, on a lifeboat when so many people weren't?
She was quoted in a book about the Irish and the Titanic and quoted in some of the news stories in the days following the Titanic's sinking as having said, "When the other girls dropped to their knees to pray, I took a run for it." So my sense is she got out while you could run and push and get your way out.
And as
I once said to a priest, "I guess my grandmother knew there was a time for praying and a time for running." And he smartly said, "No, Christine, your grandmother knew you could pray while running," which is a good rule to live by.
And as I said, she was one of only 40 Irish passengers to survive.
Right. And most of the Irish passengers were the steerage passengers, the ones, you know, down below. One of the newspapers had an interesting kind of chart or diagram of the ship. And to actually see how below they were and how small it was compared to the rest of the grandeur of the ship was kind of jarring, actually.
Well, they would just they could just as easily have come over on a freighter.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
My guest is Christine Quinn. And we're not talking about politics, although we'll probably get to politics somewhere down the line. I'm sorry about that, but that is your job. But right now we're talking about Christine's grandmother who survived the Titanic. And unfortunately, you don't know a lot of the story, but you probably have investigated a bit. But why do you think we're still talking about this particular disaster 100 years after it happened? I think it was listed as one of the three most talked about events of the 20th century.
Yeah, it's remarkable, right? I mean, I think in part what is the lure of this, the most unsinkable ship, that this thing that was ship that was supposed to be so great and so perfect wasn't. I think it's also this kind of allure of these incredibly rich and fabulous people are not invincible, right? Can be taken down. And I think it was maybe, you know, one of those moments where the greatness seemed to be stopped.
There's also the class issues here.
Sure, absolutely.
These wealthy people were much more likely to survive, and the cost of a first-class ticket in some cases was more than the people like your grandmother would earn in many years.
Right. Speaking of money, there's a new book out about the Irish on the Titanic, and in that chapter on her, it says that she told the Red Cross that she lost $500 in a suitcase. She'd never seen $500. If she had $500... they were going to keep her in Ireland. But for saying you lost $500, you got $100. So clearly, word spread, tell the Red Cross you had $500. So even in a moment of stress, she was no dope.
She should have told them she lost the medal as well.
Exactly, exactly.
She might have gotten a nicer one.
Right.
New York is a very different city than it was 100 years ago. Certainly less industrial, although nannies still find jobs.
Right, right.
What do you think attracts immigrants to the city today?
I think what attracts immigrants to the city now is the same thing that attracted all four of my grandparents here. Opportunity, diversity, other immigrants, communities where people are willing to help each other, communities where people are from the same place you were or not, but people who came from a different place and know how hard that can be when you're in America. But I think it's that possibility and potential that seems to kind of literally be in the asphalt in our city.
Where did your other grandparents come from?
They all came from Ireland. Three of my grandparents were from County Cork, and one was from County Clare.
But in some ports, the Irish weren't even allowed in. Some of them were kept off on other islands.
That's right.
And for as long as a year or more, right. New York was welcoming.
Free. Right. New York has always, New York and America largely, but certainly New York has always been a place, and we had to fight to keep it that way, where immigrants are welcome. All kinds of immigrants are welcome. And when the Irish came here, my grandparents came here, it wasn't a place where you could go anywhere. And you were leaving a place where freedom wasn't expansive, and you came here, and it was.
So we're not going to ask Joe Arpaio to become our police commissioner? Well, class divisions and wealth inequality are still major issues in the city.
Absolutely.
And the country.
Interestingly, that grandmother was a nanny. My other grandmother was a lady's maid. She was actually the highest ranking woman, a servant in the household. And both of the issues around how do you help nannies and maids do better in New York are ones we're grappling with at the council. We're partnering right now with a group called the Center for Family Life, which is taking folks who do that kind of work and bringing them together and making them into worker-owned cooperatives. They formed a cleaning company called Si Se Puede, where those cleaning, mostly women, have come together. They own their company, and they've seen their salaries triple, and they're on their way to getting benefits. So
that's almost like creating a union.
Exactly.
But it's a co-op.
Exactly. And they're going to now move on to nannies and handymen. So, you know, the issues and those struggles of immigrants who often go into those kind of jobs still very much exist, but there's better potential now, I think, to help them.
But the wealthy don't have as many people in service as they did in
1912. Oh, my God, no, right. There seemed to be a servant from everything from, you know, polishing the forks to polishing your shoes.
Have you supported the Occupy Wall Street protesters who are kind of complaining about the same inequities?
You know, it's interesting. I was on a panel last night that the New Yorker magazine sponsored about the presidential election. And we were talking about Occupy Wall Street and the Tea Party. And I made the point, which I think is true. The Tea Party, when it's all said and done, may have elected some people to Congress, but they will have done nothing. All they will have done is stopped things. If you look at the Occupy Wall Street, which is certainly not going to elect Occupy Wall Street members to Congress. That's not their point. But you can argue that the entire degree to which income inequality is part of now the national discussion was really amplified by that movement. And I think that when we look back, Occupy Wall Street will have had a more significant impact than the Tea Party.
You recently pushed for the adoption of the prevailing wage bill. Were you surprised when the mayor opposed it?
No. No, the mayor had been one thing the mayor is clear. And that's good when somebody's kind of your partner in working on legislation. He had always made it very clear to me that if we passed the prevailing wage bill, he would veto it.
Have you talked about it with him?
Oh, yes. We've talked about it a lot. And neither of us was able to change the other's position. So he vetoed it, or he will. I mean, he may not have done it yet. And we will override the veto.
The Hudson Yards development on the west side appears to be exempted from the living wage bill. Why was that included?
We're finalizing the final draft, but that is more than likely what will happen in the final draft. The living wage bill, just like the prevailing wage, is forward-looking, right? It's future projects. So things like Hudson Yards, things like Fresh Direct that were already well along in the pipeline. You'll remember Coach was announced as an anchor tenant maybe a month to 6 weeks before we reached an agreement on living wage. Our intention was never to go backwards, but to get future deals moving forward. And most of the leases, deals, whatever, on Hudson Yards are well along in the negotiation. So it was really, although a bit was made of it in the papers, it's really just grandparenting.
Well, in an editorial, the New York Post said that additional exceptions would render the bill practically meaningless in terms of its actual effect.
I disagree with that. I mean, if you look at every other jurisdiction that has living wage bills, none of them have anywhere near the economic development size of projects or a program that we have. This bill, when it gets passed into law, will cover more employees in more sectors than any other living wage bill anywhere else in the country. And if you look at some of the other cities that have these programs, they've never been used. We know for sure there's already projects in the pipeline that will be covered by this when they get that point in the process.
Another controversial development, of course, is the NYU plan. And Manhattan Borough President Scott Stringer has come out in support of the expansion now that the school has agreed to scale back on some of its plans. What are your feelings about it?
Well, in the land use process, which NYU is obviously going through, it goes from the community board to the borough president, and then it'll make its way to the city council. So now that the borough president has finished his part of the process, and I applaud him for getting concessions that were certainly ones that I heard the community wanted, and I think he did a good job, the project now will be making its way to us in the council. And I don't really take a position on land use issues until we've begun our part of the work, which is what will happen now.
Do you see the city as emerging from the recession?
I do see the city emerging from the recession, though that said, we're not emerged. And we need to remember that we had high unemployment in communities in this city, double-digit unemployment before the recession. So we need to think about emerging, not just in, you know, making up the jobs we lost, which we largely have done, but in coming out better than we went into it, because some neighborhoods had 50% unemployment.
Aren't you getting married in a little over a month?
I am. Ah, don't say it like it's that close. But somebody just sent me recently an expiration date on a half and half, and it was after my wedding date. I went into palpitations. But yes, May 19th, and there's a lot on the to-do list.
You're doing a lot of prep?
Yes, a lot of prep.
Well,
but it's all fun. We had our
And where are you going to get married?
We're getting married in Chelsea.
Uh-huh.
So, and we had our tasting on Friday at the caterers, which was actually completely, you know, but it was really, really fun.
Am I going to make it onto the guest list? It's okay. It's okay, Christine.
I don't want to answer if the interview is still ongoing. The questions could get way
worse.
Well,
we're on the air. Christine Quinn, of course, is the New York City Council Speaker, and she is the granddaughter of one of the survivors of the Titanic sinking. And it's been a great pleasure talking with
you
again.
Thank you.